Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan.
Brought to you by Active Iron
on News Talk.
Kevin, was one of a number of stories we heard here in the show yesterday. Many of you got in touch with your own experiences, your own emails as well, last night and early this morning. Marie was one of those who sent in an email. Marie, you were listening to Kevin. Tell us about your family situation. Why did you get in touch?
I got in touch because I caught the end of the discussion with Kevin, and my heart went out to Kevin. I could totally recognise what he was saying. It's the position my mum found herself in latter years, as she was the sole carer for my sister. And the situation that he described for carers, where you don't have basic access to a night's sleep, access to leave to attend to your own medical care, any ability to be ill yourself, any ability to potentially leave your house when you need to or when you even want to, no ability to take a holiday. This is the condition that carers in Ireland are finding themselves in on a day-to-day basis across the country at the moment.
Tell us a little bit about your sister, Marie.
So my sister is going to be turning 35 this year. She has a condition called polymicrogyria, which means she has intellectual impairment, the intellectual capacity of maybe a 7 or an 8-year-old. She has chronic epileptic seizures. She can walk, but she has paralysis on one side of her body. And she was a very social being in her early years, right up to her 20s. But as she's aged, into her 30s, she's become less social and has had more behavioural challenges. So her situation and her care needs increased as she got older. We managed everything within the family until she was in her mid to late 20s. And then the need for support became very clear.
And up until that point, Marie, in your sister's mid to kind of late 20s, it was your mum, was it, who was her full-time carer?
Mum was the full-time carer. Family members, siblings, we filled in blanks around my mum when needed, but she was the sole carer. She's a widow, so she was doing this on her own.
How difficult was that for your mum, Marie?
She did it with a heart and a half, so I would say she wouldn't say she found it difficult, but she did end up sacrificing her identity, her social life, her friendships and her independence, to provide care for my sister. But I guess where it really presented a challenge was when she got sick herself. So she had liver autoimmune disease and needed to take immunotherapeutics for this, which was a bit like having chemo. And at that point, it was clear that she was seriously unwell at times herself. And then she developed atrial fibrillation, subsequently heart failure. And across all of this, there was no assessment of her wellness or ability to care. The assumption and the need for her to care just continued. There was no check mechanism in the system to say, hang on, this is a person that's too elderly and too unwell to care.
Nobody asked, how is the carer?
People ask, but there is no process that happens. So many times social workers came to the house and did assessments, wrote big long essays about how unsuitable this was. But there was no follow-up. Many times the same people would change job. There was nothing in the system to say, this person's no longer fit to care. We must find a suitable solution. There's no planning in place. There's only a response to absolute crisis.
And in those years, because we're talking, Marie, I take it, about maybe 24, 25 years when your sister was at home and your mum was looking after her.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any respite? Was there any support services from the state?
There was not. She was in a daycare centre and provided daycare services, but there were times where she would refuse to attend these. And when she would refuse, then that was it. So those were not an option at that point. And those service providers did everything they could, but that was the limit of their capability and what they had to offer. And in terms of respite, she went one time, she refused it the next time, and then she was never offered it again. That was the end of respite. As it got towards the stage of life where she was more difficult to care for, her needs were increasing and my mum was becoming more unwell, when we inquired about respite, one, there were no places. This is in Cork City, big population, still no places. And the second aspect was we were advised, because she's behaviourally so challenging, we're better off to try not to get respite, because if she goes and has a bad experience, it's going to be even harder to get her to be willing to go to a residential care setting in the end. So perhaps don't even look for respite, because it might make it even harder for you to get a residential place for her in the end.
And it just sounds so unfair, Marie. It sounds like a little bit of a horror story.
It's a total horror story, and also there's a huge amount of opaqueness in the system. I think in terms of people that believe they're going about getting care, there is no clear mechanism for which to access it. GPs can identify the need for care. Social workers identify the need for care. Family members cry out for care, write letters. There's not a process. There's not a button to press. And I find it astounding that on the national level, you know, my sister's been diagnosed since she was three, could not live independently. That was clear from that point on. At the age of late 20s, when I contacted disability services, there was no awareness of her in the system because she's been cared for by her family. So there was no sense that she existed. There's no plan. There's no national statistics. You know, I don't think people could tell you now that in 20 years' time, there's this many people with these conditions who will require full-time care in these regions. Therefore, we need this many placements. There's nothing like this information gathering going on.
So your sister was effectively sort of, or the, you know, I don't want to say diagnosed, but the extent of her illness became a reality at 3 years of age. And here we are now, 32 years down the road, and it's as though this is new news. Nobody, there was no foresight. There's been no plan.
There's no plan. And even within the disability services in the local region in Cork, there was awareness of the complexity of her needs. The family had been well advised there are no beds, there are no places, and yet there was no escalation to create a plan, despite the obvious scenario becoming worse and worse. When my mum was quite obviously going to require hospitalisation herself, was quite obviously degenerating, we were escalating it with all the services we could for 6 months, 18 months, in a dire way, saying this is an immediate crisis, and yet still no action taken, no plan.
Where is your sister now, Marie?
So the current location of my sister and where she has lived for the last 12 months, because she requires 24/7 care, is Cork University Hospital. This is the only place at the moment that has been identified where she can be looked after and her needs can be met.
And this, so your sister is living in an emergency hospital setting?
Correct. She's living in a medical acute assessment unit.
Which I'm sure isn't the right place for your sister.
It isn't the right place for my sister, not in any shape, way, or form. Yeah. Having said that, the nursing care, the level of staff.
Oh, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that at all, Marie. I'm sure she's been incredibly, incredibly well looked after. But your sister isn't in an emergency setting where she requires, you know, immediate medical treatment. Your sister, from what I take from what you're saying, requires a long term living setting. It's not a hospital. Correct. She needs.
Correct. Yes. But unfortunately, in the you know, we've all heard the advertising campaigns in the last year about the rights of people with disability to live independently. This is a UN right. It's absolutely correct and should be pursued. However, the dismantling and removal of residential care settings across the country has reduced the number of placements and beds available for people with complex intellectual disability and behavioural problems. Not people who can potentially work and maybe assimilate into a community, but people with more complex needs than that, perhaps more behavioural challenges. For these people, the types of residences where they used to get placements are gradually disappearing, the beds are closing, they're being removed, but they aren't being replaced with state-organised institutions or charity-led institutions as they were previously. They're rather being outsourced to private settings or just not available. There just is no beds. There just are no places.
Those private settings are brilliant. They're great. But the problem is capacity. We don't have enough space.
Yes, that is the problem. The problem is capacity and also organisation. So to access all these different private assessments involves engaging with a group for potentially a 6 month assessment, which at the end of it may or may not be successful. We've been through a few of those 12 months in. None with success to date. Many with geographical challenges that seem unrealistic. But beyond that, the state doesn't seem, and is very clearly saying, that in regions like Cork and Kerry, there are no suitable placements. There have been no places suitable for the last 12 months.
So your 35-year-old sister is now living in Cork University Hospital. She really, really requires, I suppose, a long-term, you know, living facility with support services around her, not a hospital. Are you living in Cork, Marie, or your family?
I live in the UK. One of my brothers lives in Australia. And then I have one brother and one sister living in the Cork region who are run off their feet. There's not any other way to describe it. They do an awful lot of running to try and keep my sister comfortable and also to help with my mum, who's also been very unwell.
How is she now?
She, a couple of weeks ago, her heart failure was so severe that she couldn't walk from one end of her room to the other. But after a period of hospitalization, she's doing a bit better. She's got some more steps back. But I mean, she struggled a lot with social aspects when she had to try and rehabilitate herself and potentially go for walks and exercise, because she hadn't been able to leave the house in years and it was just not an option for her. And that leads to it becoming more difficult to leave the house. You actually become quite institutionalized in your role as a carer, and it's difficult to find your feet as an older person if you do no longer have the burden of care every day. There is an age past which caring becomes physically inappropriate and also mentally quite inappropriate as well.
Because I take it your mum wouldn't be physically able to look after your sister at the moment.
Even if she was in good health, my mum is a small woman, you know, and my sister is quite a big person. So when she would have a seizure and be on the floor, my mum had no capability to lift her, for example, or to move her into a different setting. She would have to call on a neighbour. Perhaps see if there was anyone walking up and down the street who could help her lift her, or call an ambulance or the police. These are the day-to-day situations that arise if you're caring for somebody when you're just physically, you know, not really set up for it.
But I take it, you know, Marie, that over the years, had your mum have been offered an opportunity to keep your sister at home and to have care supports and various different services, you know, in and out to help, that probably would have been an option she'd have gone for.
Yes, there was a time where carers would have been brilliant, you know, and a care package would have been brilliant. But I guess what we got was the care package at the point where we needed the residential care. You know, it came too late in the process. So at the point where we were beginning to get carers, the need was much greater than what a care package could cover. Care packages, you know, again, the carers are amazing, but they're not often, you know, allowed to administer medications, which if you're epileptic can be problematic. There's high throughput of staff, which if somebody is complex and has behavioural difficulties is again tricky. So this would have been great earlier on when it wasn't available, but not so much in the latter days.
I just want to go back to something you mentioned a few moments ago. You talked about when your mum was minding your sister and caring for your sister at home, Marie, how difficult that was, like not being able to leave the house, the impact on her social life, friendships, and the loss of her own identity.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the most difficult things that people don't talk about is if COVID came. COVID came and care services stopped. So for people like my mum and my sister, given my mum was on immunotherapeutics, she was vulnerable, my sister was also vulnerable, they lived in total isolation with no care support for the duration of COVID. You know, both my siblings that live in Cork were working in healthcare and in group settings where they represented a real risk. So after that period of isolation, when my sister's behavioural challenges intensified, probably due to an inability to cope and process all of the changes and the isolation that happened at that time, she had to cope with it behind closed doors alone. And when those doors opened, I think people like her expected a flood of help. You know, here will come the help to give you respite, to give you reprieve. But what actually happened was a massive shortage in the social care sector, less headcount, less people, less services available, and a massive reduction in any ability to support respite and care for the carers across Ireland.
I don't want to make light of anybody that is caring for a loved one or a family member at the moment and possibly listening to us here today on Lunchtime Live, Marie. But to my mind, the only other scenario where you can think of somebody who is at home, who can't leave their house, who's in total isolation, has no connection with the outside world, the only other scenario where that presents itself is in prison, in solitary confinement.
That is exactly correct. And I think the intensity of the situation people find themselves in is so bleak and so isolating and so inhumane and so not understood that it's really such a sad thing. And this is where the carers that are living in this situation need the good people of Ireland to advocate for them, because these are people that don't have the time to advocate for themselves. They can't leave their home to advocate for themselves. It doesn't mean their situation isn't dire. It is incredibly dire. They need every single person in the country to speak to their politicians and say they will only vote in parties that have a very clear policy on change in this area. I mean, when you look at what happens, you know, when people don't provide respite, don't provide residential care when it's needed, It leads to people effectively working for the state into their beyond into their 80s, into their 90s. People are doing this, and they're doing it 24/7 without any rights to look after themselves, without any humanity, and no check mechanism to stop it either.
Kevin was with us on the show yesterday, and he shared his story with the program, with the public, with the nation. And he was informed after that his situation was going to change, you know, the respite care and service that he needed, he would now get. Yeah. And what really kind of, you know, galls me in all of this, Marie, is that he had to come on national radio yesterday.
Yeah, I understand that. And I have heard people come on the radio before, carers, and heard the immediate response afterwards from an official to create their position. And I always hear the same thing. First, I hear blame. This is what the family did wrong. They refused this placement. They didn't accept this service. Even, you know, in cases like my sister's, where everybody, her life is based in Cork City, everyone she knows, her placement, the first placement she was offered was in Louth, which is a 5-hour drive away. The first thing an official will say is they've been offered placements, they've refused placements. Obviously, the family are wrong in this case to refuse these placements without any regard for practicality. The second is we've provided a care package. Now, the classic thing with a care package is an inability to deliver the care package agreed. So we had this many, many years, which is that we were offered this many hours, approved this many hours of the care package, but often there wasn't the staff to deliver it. This isn't the fault of an agency, it's a fault of lack of people on the ground in these high throughput jobs. So there's little sticky plasters going over these situations, but there's fundamental systemic problem here. There's fundamental systemic error, and there is no mechanism being created to actually tackle the root problems. What we're doing is pussyfooting around it and creating PR campaigns and really not getting down to how many places are needed and how many places have been provided. And in what regions? There are whole regions of the country, all over the country, there are people with these needs. We can't localise these services to just Leinster or to just certain regions. Everywhere has people living in communities with these challenges, and they all need respite and care, and not at a great distance from their families. One of the big things I wanted to communicate today was the unacceptability of only providing residential places in random pockets across the country. These, you know, so moving people from Cork to Louth, from Kerry to Dundalk, this isn't appropriate. These are vulnerable people. They can't communicate. They have established relationships, friendships and families in their communities. When you disenfranchise them by moving them to other places under the guise of independent living, what you're actually doing is isolating them in a community where they know nobody, rather than enabling them to exist within their community and to be supported by the
community. They might as well be in prison, Marie.
Well, when you move people who can't communicate to a place where they know nobody, you make them vulnerable, you remove their protection, you remove their family network.
It sounds like a prison.
It's not a wise thing to do, even systemically, because, you know, often these are isolated houses, yeah. They're not co-located. You know, there's an easy solution to this, and that's in every region we need co-located houses within purpose-built sites where there's shared facilities and people can access respite and residential care. It's not rocket science.
Lunchtime Live at newstalk.com. That's the email address. If you've been listening to Marie today or Kevin yesterday and you want to get in touch and share your story with us, Marie, thank you for joining us in the programme.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan. Weekdays at midday.
Brought to you by Active Iron
on News Talk.